This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Berman. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo touched down in Paris today. He'll meet with French President Emmanuel Macron on Monday before heading to Turkey, Israel, and several other countries in his seven-nation tour. A French official said that Macron is receiving Pompeo at the Secretary of State's request and in, quote, full transparency with President-elect Joe Biden's team, end quote, adding that contacts with Biden are established and operational. President Donald Trump not conceded the U.S. election, but many world leaders are already turning their attention to Biden, who is largely projected to take over as the U.S. president in January. France, like many allies, has had sharp disagreements with Trump on issues from climate change to trade to Iran. In Jerusalem, Pompeo will see Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is a close partner of Trump, but who has congratulated Biden. Other countries Pompeo will visit include Saudi Arabia, on which Biden has vowed to press harder on human rights. The U.S. Secretary of State will also visit Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates, and Qatar. The country of Georgia is also on the list. Georgia is a U.S. ally that has just gone through an election disputed by the losing side. Lebanese Security Chief Abbas Ibrahim visited Damascus after a trip to Washington as part of efforts to free U.S. citizen Austin Tice, who is being detained in Syria. Lebanese media is reporting this today. Ibrahim told local media that he went on a two-day visit to Damascus and contacted Tice's mother to tell her that he would continue to work on her son's file. U.S. President Donald Trump has adopted the case of the freelance journalist and former U.S. Marine who disappeared while reporting in Syria in 2012. This is VOA News. Villagers outside of Nagorno-Karabakh set their homes on fire Saturday before fleeing to Armenia ahead of a weekend deadline that will see disputed territory handed over to Azerbaijan as part of a peace agreement. Residents of the Kalbahar district in Azerbaijan that was controlled by Armenian separatists for decades began a mass exodus this week. It was announced Azerbaijan would regain control of this area on Sunday. Fighting between the separatists backed by Armenian troops and the Azerbaijan army erupted over the Nagorno-Karabakh breakaway region in late September and raged for 6 weeks. Armenia on Saturday said that 2,317 of its fighters were killed in the clashes, an increase of nearly 1,000 deaths compared to the last confirmed death toll among Armenian fighters. Azerbaijan has not revealed its military casualties, and the real toll after weeks of fighting is expected to be much higher. The two ex-Soviet rivals agreed to end hostilities earlier this week after previous efforts by Russia, France, and the United States to get a ceasefire fell through. A key part of the peace deal includes Armenia's return of three districts by December 1st, which have been held by Armenians since a devastating war in the 1990s. Well, Diwali is meant to be the festival of light, but the coronavirus pandemic has dimmed that light for many of India's 1.3 billion people celebrating the biggest Hindu holiday on Saturday. High pollution levels are also affecting celebrations. New Delhi has banned firecrackers because of sky-high pollution levels, and while people still throng markets, traders said COVID-19 had scared them off spending. With 8.7 million cases, India has the world's second highest coronavirus infection count behind the United States. About 130,000 people have died from COVID-19 in India since February, and Delhi is going through a new surge with nearly 8,000 new cases a day. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and most of his ministers put out traditional Diwali greetings. May everyone be prosperous and healthy, Modi told his 63.5 million Twitter followers. But the government is struggling to kickstart an economy that is expected to shrink by nearly 10% this year because of the pandemic crisis. Millions across the country have lost their jobs. For more on these and other international stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Berman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
I think people are realizing that indeed he was the founder of the Fourth Republic. But when he came saying that his revolution was one that was going to end all revolutions, I think it has come to pass, and that is very true.
A Ghanaian opposition party suspends its campaign to mourn the death of former President Jerry John Rawlings.
The whole world, including CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, everybody, the world saw it. Even if you come and deny, the whole world saw what they did to peaceful protesters in Nigeria. So there is no gainsaying the fact that no matter what they do, they may get away with it now, but subsequently they will not.
A major Nigerian political pressure group petitions the Inspector General of Police to investigate those responsible for violence during the recent youth protests.
We have COVID for the first time going in an election. So police also has to avoid COVID. They can use it as an excuse or an event approach. So it's a question of how much force have you used. But there are some candidates who have shown they are going to confront the police no matter what the police say. We will not comply.
And Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni promises to scrap fees at the government-run primary schools if he wins re-election next year. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghana's opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP, has suspended its political activities for a week to mourn the death of former President Jerry John Rawlings. Nana Kunedu Ajiman Rawlings, the wife of the late former president, is the party's presidential candidate for the upcoming December 7 general election. Ghanaians go to the polls next month to choose a new president, parliament, and local representatives. Some analysts suggest Mrs. Rawlings should end her campaign following the death of her husband. However, others contend that she should participate in the polls. NDP spokesperson Mohammed Frimpong tells me that she would follow her husband's desire to improve probity and accountability within Ghana's government.
The event came as a shock to the entire country, and much more so to a party that belongs to what I call the Rawlings tradition in fond memory of the late president. All party activities of the National Democratic Party countrywide, you know, and probably see how best, you know, to resume later. Fortunately, it's a decision that has been taken countrywide, you know, by the president. Flags are flying at half mast in the memory of the late president, who is so much associated with the National Democratic Party. Just like I've said, we draw inspiration from his vision.
Now that the party and the country as a whole is in mourning, let me ask specifically about your party. After the one-week mourning process, will your party consider even the candidacy of your presidential candidate, who is the wife of the former president? Because, as you know, some people are even speculating that perhaps she might decide not to even run again. After this mourning period, what will be the party's next line of action?
Of course, the best way to eternalize the memory and legacy of President Rawlings will be to continue, and this I mean our flag bearer. Let me also draw your attention to the fact that all the processes to the candidature of our flag bearer had been completed. So it's foreclosed. You know, it's not something that she might decide that, okay, I'm withdrawing, because the necessary processes are already completed, printing of ballot papers and so on and so forth. And the best form of eternalizing the memory of the late president is to ensure that at least his vision, which has so much sustained the Fourth Republic, is amplified in political activity. And that can be best, you know, carried out by the National Democratic Party. You know, we are what are called a pristine Rawlings' political party in terms of what I call a testament be sustained. And that can only be done with the presence, you know, or with the continuation of our flag bearer, Dr. Mrs. Nana Kunal-Gajman Rawlings, as at now.
So therefore, you are saying basically that your party will carry the vision and the legacy of the deceased former president ahead or during the upcoming December 7 elections.
Exactly so. We have already been known to be that party that is very much close and committed to the ideals of the late president. I mean, in terms of the fact that we place leadership over a sway of the electorate into what we call political goodies today. And, you know, we are saying, yes, we've done very well, but there are still challenges. And it's only the National Democratic Party, which, in fact, is on the path to making sure that at least the job is accomplished, even now that the late president is no more.
What is the party's reaction after seeing the entire country mourn the loss of the former Ghanaian leader?
Well, that demonstrated the greatness. And in spite of the enigma surrounding his tenure as a leader, the entire nation has come to realize that, in fact, his demise is a very big loss. And I mean, his opponents, his detractors and lovers, you know, all together are extolling his great, great achievements. You know, now I think people are realizing that indeed he was the founder of the Fourth Republic. In fact, when he came saying that his revolution was one that was going to end all revolutions, I think it has come to pass, and that is very true. We've not had any republic that had run and endured for so long, 28 years, in spite of all the challenges, come to accept it. But of course, we do not have to be complacent, because certain challenges can make it run creaky.
Mohamed Frimpong is the spokesperson for the Ghanaian Opposition National Democratic Party, or NDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Concerned Nigeria, a political pressure group, is calling on the Inspector General of Police to launch an investigation into violence during recent youth protests. The group says it has evidence of people who turned the peaceful protest into violence. Youth protesters were demanding greater inclusion in the country's politics and for an end to police brutality, including extrajudicial killings. The political pressure group says some Nigerians used the demonstration as cover to attack the police and peaceful protesters. Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concerned Nigeria. He tells me that the government should support the prosecution of those responsible for the violence, irrespective of their political affiliation or status in society.
Well, you know, basically it was premised on the fact that several pro-government groups mobilized to disrupt the protests in Lagos and in Abuja, you know, and this did not go on without notice by the press, by civil society groups, and even the generality of Nigerians. And as such, we believe that, you know, these things cannot happen without backing of security agencies. There is no how that the security agencies will say that these things like this happened and they did not know. Because majority of the thugs who attacked protesters were doing it 300, 400 feet away from the first headquarters where the Inspector General of Police is. And this is not the first time that things like this are happening in Abuja.
Now that you have officially petitioned the Inspector General of Police, do you have empirical evidence to support this assertion that some people gathered people, paid them to cause trouble during the protests?
Yes. In fact, the petition is accompanied by exhibits. And these exhibits, you know, depict a frontline supporter of the president actively mobilized people in Abuja, thugs, trained them, and made arrangements
So we are giving the police this evidence for police to interrogate her, ask her questions. How did this thing happen? When did it happen? So that she may be in a position to name more people. You know, and this is how things are done. And you recall that in Lagos, similar things were done. Faces of these people are on the internet. There's one of the famous talks that we also attach his picture. The Nigerian police will invite these people. One of the talks that we attached in the petition was holding a market and attacked peaceful protesters in Lagos. These people should be arrested, interrogated, and charged. You know, this is how to show that the government does not have a hand in all these things.
But Deji, some people are suggesting that you are blaming the government for actions that you took, for which degenerated into violence. So it's like the government cannot win. You organize protests against the government. The protests turned violent, and you blame the government for it.
The protest did not turn violent. We are all in this country. We saw government vehicles in Lagos, BRT buses, were used to carry ferry tugs to protest venue to attack protesters. In Abuja, right in Abuja, we saw thugs in SUVs pointing fingers at who they should go and attack. So how does making demand on the government result into thug violence against peaceful protesters? Now, in a democracy, people cannot make demand. People cannot protest. The freedom of assembly will become a crime in a democracy, in a so-called democracy.
Have you given the Inspector General of Police the time period by which to respond to your official?
We have given a lead. The Inspector General of Police will investigate the allegations contained in our petition. We have given a lead already. And we have given evidence to say, this woman, this is her role, this is what she did. This thug in Lagos, this is what he did. This is the empirical evidence. There are video clips as well. Do something. If you say to do something, then you people, you are the one that sent them. So things like this cannot continue in a democracy, that the method of suppressing peaceful protests will be thug violence. It can no longer be business as usual. And that's why if you read the concluding part of our petition, we said that in the Federal Police, remember that when we were attacked in December, we wrote the petition to him and he did nothing. So this petition is so that posterity will judge us right, that we wrote the first time in December 2019, we wrote to the Federal Police, they did nothing. Now we have written again. So we have placed the body on the Federal Police to do the right thing.
Deji, if the Inspector General of Police doesn't act, what's next for your group? Because some people I spoke with said, this just appears like a publicity stunt and nothing will come out of it.
If nothing will come out of it, at least let them prove us right. Let them prove us right that nothing will come out of it. The last one we did, the records are there. You know, the reason why these things are good is so that posterity will remember that they did the wrong thing and that we cried out. And the whole world, including CNN, BBC, and they said that everybody, the world saw it. Even if you come and deny, the whole world saw what they did to peaceful protesters in Nigeria. So there is no gainsaying the fact that no matter what they do, they may get away with it now, but subsequently, they will not.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concerned Nigeria, a political pressure group. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is coming under criticism for promising to scrap fees charged at government-run primary schools if he is re-elected. The president's proposal is outlined in the ruling party's manifesto, but critics say his promise is yet another admission that he has failed to meet the aspirations of the people and to resolve the challenges facing the country. This as human rights groups are expressing concern about a sharp rise in politically related violence and police brutality in the run-up to the polls. Ugandans cast their votes next year to elect a new president, parliament, and local representatives. For deeper insight into the latest political situation following the president's promise, I reached Fred Muhumuza, an economist and political analyst in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Yeah, I think there are two things that need to be observed and taken into consideration, because at the primary school level, we have universal primary education, which is free. However, there are other functional additional charges, because the money that government gives the schools as capitation grants to compensate for the school fees and operations of the schools is not adequate. So most of the school boards agreed with the parents, where parents would contribute money to top up the teachers' meager salaries, but also there were teachers who were not even on the government payroll and the schools needed them. Now the president is saying those additional costs became too big and have actually nullified the original objective of universal primary education, because some children have actually fallen and dropped out of school because of these costs. So those are the costs he was referring to, because they were not being well monitored by the central government system and also analyzed to make sure they do not prohibit children from coming to school as those costs kept on increasing.
But Fred, some people are suggesting that he has been president for a very long time. He knows the problem. Why hasn't he fixed it until now that he's seeking re-election next year?
Yes, of course, there are two things again here. One is he always gets his system to inform him, and sometimes the system is not as effective to give him the information. Let's not forget that some of the people may be having conflict of interest, because some of the people in government run private schools. So when these costs do come through and complaints do come through, it is possible somebody can hide this information from the president. So that's one route, that the information may not have reached the president. And now he's going around walking through the communities looking for a political mandate. He's able to interface directly without going through a system that may not be very efficient and picking up these evidences. That is one side of the story. The second part is, so initially parents might agree that can we contribute $1 every term? And the term in Uganda is about 90 days. And parents may see that as acceptable and affordable. But over years, you may find schools have added more things that have eventually become prohibitive. I've personally been involved on behalf of the ministry to check the causes of this cost.
How is this playing out among the population? And how can the opposition compete with such pronouncement from the president?
It doesn't disempower them. So any member of the opposition is free to come and engage it and come up with their proposal. The president may have said, I will remove it. The other people may come with a more positive way, because some parents are willing to make a contribution to buy food communally for their children who don't feed from the government allocation, but also to pay some of the teachers, because the government teachers may be few and they are needed more, and they are convinced we need these teachers and it is us to pay them. So there is a conversation that any member of the opposition can really present their message and let the people decide on the basis of who is speaking the best as far as this issue is concerned.
There have been reports of violence against opposition leaders or opposition figures. Patrick Amoriad, when he went to present his document at the Electoral Commission, Robert Kyagulanyi Obubuwine and his supporters faced a similar thing. And a lot of people are saying that sometimes perhaps the opposition leaders are to blame for not adhering to the Ministry of Health guidelines about the spread of the coronavirus. Some are also saying this is yet another attempt by the government to suppress the opposition in the run-up to the election next year. What is the situation on the ground when it comes to violence, allegedly meted out by the Ugandan police or security agencies?
It's quite an interesting thing, and I think you have put all the facts in your question. So it's a very good question for people to engage, because let's not forget these are 11 candidates, and only the two you have mentioned seem to be always on the confrontation path consistently with the police. You might be wrong, but don't be wrong on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it becomes the norm, especially when the others are not even having a problem. So I think there are two ways about this. There are those who are going out to annoy the police, and of course some of them have literally said for them they are going to run their campaign in a defiance mode. Now, if you make that your label, then the police is also going to come knowing this one said he will always be defiant, not compliant. So I want to say in some cases it has gone overboard. Police has used maybe what we call excessive force and intervention. But in the light of not just affecting the presidential candidate, we have COVID for the first time going in an election. So police also has to avoid COVID. They can use it as an excuse or an escape route. So it's a question of how much force have you used. But there are some candidates who have shown they are going to confront the police no matter what the police say. We will not comply. I find that also not completely a blame on the police. The police may be blamed for excessive force, but if somebody has already said, me, I am going to run my thing like business as usual, then we really are preempting a ruthless police action. So we are watching police action, but now the good thing, as researchers, we have a sample of 11 candidates considered.
Fred Muhumuza is an economist and political analyst. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Human rights groups are calling on the authorities in Tunisia to stop using old laws to crack down on free speech on social media. Critics say that violates free speech, which is guaranteed by the constitution.
The criticism comes after Amnesty International documented instances where bloggers and administrators of popular Facebook pages, opposition activists and human rights defenders face criminal prosecution for their views on various internet platforms. But supporters of the administration say citizens should be held accountable when they violate the North African country's laws. They urged the government to continue prosecuting those they accuse of using social media to create tension and instability. Fida Hamami is an Amnesty International researcher in Tunisia. She tells me that it is unacceptable for the government to violate the constitution by cracking down on free speech.
We have documented 40 cases over the past 2 years, and these are the 40 cases that Amnesty International documented. It doesn't mean that there only are these 40 cases. They are cases of bloggers, managers of widely followed Facebook pages, activists or regular Facebook users who have written Facebook posts about corruption, corruption allegation, or maybe Facebook posts that are critical of the police or some state officials. A lot of these people found themselves being investigated by the police, and sometimes these investigations led to them being prosecuted in a court of law for quote unquote, offending people through telecommunications network or for attributing false claims to government officials and such articles that contain very broad terms and definitions of what could be basis for restricting freedom of speech. So we are hoping that Tunisian prosecutors would stop using these laws that are in urgent need of to be amended to restrict freedom of speech online.
Fida, what do you say to the authorities who are of the opinion that these prosecutions are necessary to ensure that the country remains peaceful and stable, and that a lot of these activists are using social media to create tension and disunity in the country?
I would say that freedom of expression and freedom of the press are among the most important human rights gains that the Tunisian people have achieved since 2011. Tunisia's constitution guarantees the right to freedom of expression in Article 31, and Tunisia is party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that guarantees freedom of expression in Article 19. International law provides very, very specific ways in which freedom of expression could be at times restricted, and that should be to protect the general peace, and it should be to protect reputations. It should not be to restrict criticism, and it should not be to curtail legitimate criticism, especially when it comes to criticizing transgressions in police conduct or corruption by officials. So I would say that it is not a way to keep the peace, to restrict freedom of expression.
Some supporters agree that although there's freedom of expression guaranteed by the Constitution, some people are taking advantage of it using social media to spread fake news and unproven allegations, tarnishing the reputations of people in society, and that when you make those allegations, you need to back it up, and that is why the prosecutions are continuing. What do you say to that?
I would like to answer that in two parts. The first one is following up on what I've been saying on restrictions that could be legitimately imposed on freedom of expression and that are provided for in international law. These must be very specific in the purpose that they have to serve. Protecting the reputation of others is very different from protecting the feelings of someone that might have been offended by legitimate criticism. And either way, all of these allegations of defamation, for instance, should not lead to prison sentences. And there must be procedural safeguards against abusive impositions of restrictions, including provision for appeal to an independent body, and also all the guarantees to a fair trial. The second part would be that we detail in our report the cases that we documented, and none of them actually are about spreading of fake news, for instance. We have a few cases where the person shared satirical caricature of police. They did not write anything, they did not claim anything, they shared something by a cartoonist. And that person found the police at their door when they left. And they are now being investigated according to Article 86 of the Telecommunications Code that says that anybody who offends or disturbs the peace of someone through the telecommunication networks is liable to up to 2 years in prison. That is in no way a proportionate or legitimate sentence, and that is in no way grounds for prosecution for someone. Very much similar cases are the ones we're talking about.
Fida, some Tunisians are expressing concern that calls for the authorities to adhere to your call for the respect of freedom of expression might not necessarily come into being because this process is going to continue. What can civil activists do in Tunisia to respect the rights of people to freely express their views and opinion as enshrined in the Tunisian constitution?
We have put out a petition, an electronic petition today, together with our report that we hope people would be massively signing, asking the authorities to stop prosecutions and drop charges against people that are being prosecuted right now. And we also would like to see people that are active in the reform sphere in Tunisia and in human rights field in Tunisia prioritizing these much overdue amendments.
Fida Hamami is an Amnesty International researcher in Tunisia. She spoke with me from the capital, Tunis. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet is calling for urgent measures to protect civilians who are at the mercy of marauding armed groups in Mozambique's northern Cabo Delgado province. For the UAE, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
According to media reports, dozens, maybe scores of people were beheaded by Islamist militants in northern Mozambique earlier this month. The escalating violence in Cabo Delgado province has sent thousands of people fleeing by land and by sea to escape what is thought to be an increasingly dangerous and chaotic situation. Thousands of others reportedly remain trapped in conflict areas, with many forced to hide in the bush for days. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet calls their situation desperate. Her spokesman, Rupert Colville, said Friday that people trapped in areas of conflict, as well as many of those displaced across the province, have barely any means of surviving. He says some areas have been without humanitarian aid for more than 6 months.
Those who remain have been left deprived of basic necessities and are at risk of being killed, sexually assaulted, abused, kidnapped, or forcibly recruited by armed groups. And those that are that flee may die in the process.
The High Commissioner is appealing to Mozambican authorities to protect the civilians at risk and to ensure humanitarian agencies can deliver life-saving assistance to them. Spokesman Colville says there has been a string of gruesome attacks in several villages over the past 2 weeks. He says witnesses report homes and public facilities have been burned and dozens of people killed.
There have also been reports of human rights violations committed by Mozambican security forces in recent years, including extrajudicial killings, ill treatment, use of force violations, arbitrary detentions, including of journalists, and unlawful restrictions on the freedom of movement.
High Commissioner Bachelet says all parties to the conflict must strictly adhere to their obligations under international law and make sure any forces under their control do so as well. She says her office is available to support the government in its efforts to carry out the obligations and to help the people of Mozambique in any way it can. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The chief executive officer of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange says South Africa is an exciting destination for investors. Dr. Lilia Fori also says investors are looking for the effective execution of policy certainty, which she contends the country continues to demonstrate. Her remarks come after some experts wondered if the country has the legal and financial infrastructure to handle issues, including business disputes that investors may encounter. They also expressed concern that recent tensions and and xenophobic attacks could undermine efforts to attract investors. But Leila Fori, the head of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, tells me that the government in Pretoria is working to resolve challenges facing the country. She also says the ongoing partnership between the government and the private sector has created the enabling environment needed to boost investor confidence.
South Africa is an exciting investment destination for a couple of reasons. Firstly, we have deep and very well-established capital markets. Our central bank is credible, has reacted very well to the COVID crisis. Our national treasury is deeply experienced. And then secondly, insofar as COVID crisis goes, the president has acted swiftly and has responded very decisively in managing the crisis. And our economy has now completely opened up and the number of new COVID cases have dropped severely. So we are going to start growing our economy quite quickly. And then I'd say the third reason is that South Africa offers very high yields, particularly in the bond market. Our interest rates are very high relative to the other countries. In a time of global low economic growth, high yield returns are a very important factor.
Does South Africa have what it takes, including financial and legal infrastructure, particularly to handle issues of dispute when these investors come to do business in your country?
South Africa has world-class legal and financial systems in place. For many years, we have been ranked in the top categories for disclosure of financial information, for ease of doing business, and for the general level of sophistication of our infrastructure. In addition to that, we have a very strong and well-tested independent judiciary, and we've seen that the institutions and the power of the independent judiciary being tested, that has proved to stand up. And so I think that investors can feel safe that if they want to trade or invest in South Africa, that their money is safe with the country and that the legal system will be robust and will protect them as investors.
As the chief executive officer of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, what role do you think your organization can play in the drive to attract North American investors?
The Johannesburg Stock Exchange is ranked the 19th largest exchange in the world. It offers very deep liquid capital markets, especially insofar as emerging markets go. And we also offer world-class technology and infrastructure, and our clearing and settlement environment, which is vital for investors to ensure that their money is safely held and that the invested funds are protected, is world-class. We have world-class IOSCO compliance, which means that we stack up with the best standards in the world. And the country is known for its very sophisticated capital markets environment. We offer an exceptionally wide range of products, and our bond market is deep and very liquid. And bond market, as I said earlier, offers tremendous yields, particularly in relation to the underlying risk.
Earlier, you mentioned the issue of COVID-19 infection rate in South Africa. Now, there is an ongoing global COVID-19 pandemic, which, as you know, inhibits business activities. How do you plan on resolving this challenge?
The South African government have acted very swiftly, and as a result of that, we are on the front foot in responding to the crisis. We have an arrangement through our local company, Pfizer, which will be able to access Johnson & Johnson's medication. We also have a Building Back Better plan to start kickstarting the economy. The state president announced 2 nights ago that all borders will be open completely. And so we've managed the crisis very well. And as a result, we're able to attract foreign tourists. We're able to attract foreign trade, and our overall business recovery is, I would say, a lot faster than many of the emerging market peers.
There have been recent concerns about racial tension and, in some cases, xenophobic violence, which some experts are saying will undermine
investor confidence in South Africa. How do you think this can be resolved?
The rule of law is strictly upheld in the country. And while there may have been isolated incidents, in the main, the rule of law is well applied. The country is well managed, and business is functioning in an uninterrupted by any of these sorts of incidents. And so, of all the problems that we're dealing with, I think recovering from the COVID lockdown is probably a much higher priority at this stage in our economic cycle.
Leila Fourie is the Chief Executive Officer of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. She spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Sarah Kumalu, the first Black African woman to conquer Mount Everest, appears to have set a Guinness World Record for the most money raised during an 8-hour stationary cycling fundraiser. She will use the money to build digital libraries for rural children whose education has been impacted by COVID. Yuri Franco Pugilisi reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
From the highest peak of Mount Everest to a stationary bicycle, South African Sarah Kumalo is breaking new records. The first Black African woman to summit the world's tallest mountain in 2019, Kumalo gave herself a new challenge, breaking a Guinness World Record for charity. Through 8 hours of stationary cycling, Kumalo raised nearly $44,000 to build digital libraries for South Africa's rural students whose education suffered when schools closed due to the pandemic.
I think we can't afford to leave any children behind. If you look at what happened with the lockdown and COVID-19, schools that did not have digital material to support their students were really locked. Students were struggling, and we can't afford that.
Each digital library will have a mobile tablet computer with curriculum-based application and teacher training modules. Education Aid Group iSchool Africa helped fundraise for Kumalo under a team's attempt on October 25th to break the Guinness World Record. Michelle Lissus is director of the group.
We worked in partnership with the schools, with donors, with sponsors, to really change the way we teach and learn and to look for solutions in a very challenging environment.
After 8 hours of spinning, Kumalo and her team felt confident, said team member Cindy van Veek.
It was an awesome, awesome, awesome day. And at about around 1 o'clock, Sarah and I knew that we had broken the world record. Because it's for the children, it's for the children of this beautiful country.
While falling short of their personal goal to raise about $62,000, Kumalo says she will keep fundraising until they reach the peak of their goal, to build 9 digital libraries for South African children. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Steady bass, your heart beat faster while we embrace. Screaming for more while you're anticipate with my fingers below your waist. I wanna give you what you came for. The loving that you need, I got it right there. Yes, I'm gonna give you what you came for.
Day, 'cause what we have done can't replace. Yes, we are in another space. No gonna care what they say.
I wanna give you what you came for. The love and that you need, I got it right here. Yes, I wanna give you what you came for. The love and that you need, I got it. I got it. I got it. I wanna give you what you came for. The love and that you need, I got it right here. Yes, I wanna give you what you came for.
For the ladies right now, the keys to the ladies. Picha la kutisha, money full bag. Hili pati shisha, hauti mkuu fag. Watoto new age, A to Z. Kidume first class, pebeni first lady. Utamwa best bike, nice kama kudedi. Toto yuko ready, nje na kwenye bedi. Ona amenipa punje na taka plate. Na mini kores mashi ya mekula shedi. Kirusha mavest ni slim au shedi. Ujuzi na weledi, mpuza ulewi. Makuza ngolewi, mkusi nogewi. Speedy highway, moja moja one way. Nyama, nyama, lasma iliwe. Kitanda kilali chenyewe, kilaliwe. Chaguliwe nguo na badai zivoliwe. Skaguliwe zitumiwa, lafu skafuliwe. Raza Mombasa, ulinzi mambo sasa. Mapishi ya kisasa, mbishi ni menasa. Miss leo na kukisi na kupapasa. Ra uje tabata wene bars na fojasa. Bata, bar stam haswa. Kikamatwa, Boko Haramu haswa. Haya sasa, tirani na kuasa. Ukiharibu ndani ni vitasa. Wewe fali pupa, Kongo Kinshasa. Uno bila mfupa, resi Faransa. Mr. Kanda Bongo man, Mr. Kwasa Kwasa. I'm sorry honey, nipe kimoje cha faster faster.
Toa shaka, we kaka, unaraka.
Nipe badai, sindio. Moyo unakwenda mbio, muda unakwenda mbio. Kitingisha kalio, nazidisha salio. Nizungushe kama unazungusha mitandio. Nivuruge unachosema, miniseme ndio. Kivuruge wakisema, nzibe masikio. Move your body like a snake, ma. Ilete juu kama inavyopigwa Jack, ma. Moshi juu inaitwa party like a gangsta. Party la fiesta, party la kukesha. Ini atari kama party la madensa. Dani wakali kama party la kiwesta. Mr. DJ Weka, tunataka zile zinazochezeka. Usiku huu mpaka kinaeleweka.
Kibao, kibao, kibao kata. Kibao, kibao, kibao kata. Kibao, ichi kibao cha kukata. Ukiweka uso tu bao lina kunasa. Kibao, kibao, kibao kata. Kibao, kibao, kibao kata. Kibao, ichi kibao cha kukata. Ukiweka uso tu bao lina kunasa.
Yeah, kibao kata flani bebe zimejadia. Kajipange cheki mfuko livo kaka. Kama umefua utasugua gama gaga. Ukiwa poa tavua masamaki mapapa. Mini girl who you finna get never. Don't you even try to be acting all clever. When you see me I be sweet like pepper. Wait, ain't nothing them hotter. Man them, me a man them killer. Inna the rap game, me a rap game pillar. Ain't no other girl who a keep it realer. That's why me a say me the real dan dada yeah. I'm in the room, I'm still in the show. I'm better than you, you already know. A friend or a foe, I ain't none of those. But the way my flow sick, you won't wanna know.
Keep out, keep out, keep out, kata. Keep out, keep out, keep out, kata. Keep out, ichi keep out, chaku kata. Kiweka uso tu bao lina kunasa. Keep out, keep out, keep out, kata. Keep out, keep out, keep out, kata. Keep out, ichi keep out, chaku kata. Kiweka uso tu bao lina kunasa.
Thank you.
miti ya bawa.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the poor man's proverb is never quoted. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.